fear and the census today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Supreme Court blocks the government from including a citizenship question on the next census, but some worry that non-U.S. citizens will still be afraid to fill out the form.
There's been damage done here in terms of how people are perceiving the census now, because there's still going to be that fear that's out there.
We'll hear why that fear persists and why it matters. Plus, Mexico's National Guard is now patrolling the border with the U.S.
And Mexicans, some are critical. They said, why do we have our Mexican National Guard doing the job of the Border Patrol? I mean, we're stopping people from entering the U.S. There's Border Patrol right there. That's their job.
We ask, are the extra troops an effective deterrent? The answer and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Citizenship question on the census? Not for now. The Supreme Court today essentially blocked the Trump administration's proposal to ask whether a person is a citizen or not during the 2020 census. In a 5-4 ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the Commerce Department needs to give a clearer justification for putting the question on the census and return the case back to the lower courts. Julie Dowling co-chairs the Census Bureau's National Advisory Committee and has been following the case closely.
Oh, well, there's a lot at stake here. I mean, the citizenship question could have detrimental effects for our counts. We already have undercounts of Latinos, Asian Americans, various racial and linguistic minorities in this country. And to put a question on there that would deter responses from those populations would have had really disastrous impacts, particularly for states with higher immigrant populations. So California, New York, of course, here in Illinois, where I am, Texas, et cetera, those states could have lost congressional representation and indeed a lot of federal funding as well.
As you said, Julie, a big concern with the citizenship question is about whether people would participate and answer it and how that would impact the actual count. Does the removal of this question, or at least kind of we're not probably going to see it in 2020, does it solve that problem?
I mean, it will definitely be better not having it on the form. But I think at the same time, we've seen all of this coverage, basically, having this be in the news all this time for the last year. Even last year, when we had the 2018 census end-to-end test, which is like a dress rehearsal for the census, they did this in Providence, Rhode Island last summer. And the citizenship question was not on the dress rehearsal. And yet, because it was already in the media that the administration wanted to add it, they saw some decreases in participation. They saw people saying they didn't want to fill it out because of the citizenship question when the citizenship question wasn't even there yet. And so I think there's been damage done here in terms of how people are perceiving the census now, because there's still going to be that fear that's out there. However, having it not be on there will be much, much better, because we'll be able to get more people to fill out the form.
I mean, we want an accurate count, right? Is there a way to ask the citizenship question that doesn't raise these issues of de facto gerrymandering and causing fear in the immigrant population that does not want to answer that question, that, you know, there might be some reprisal?
On the census, you really just want a head count with very basic demographic information. And a citizenship question just doesn't need to be there on that count. There really isn't a need for it. We have other data that's available to generate those kinds of numbers without jeopardizing participation in a forum that is so critical for people to get, you know, both voting representation and federal funding for their communities.
You're on the Census Bureau's advisory council. Citizenship questions aside, how else is a census missing people? Like, how do race and origin questions play into this?
I was doing some research on this for many years. There are currently two separate questions on the form for Hispanic origin and race. The Hispanic origin question asks, are you Mexican, Puerto Rican, Cuban, or some other Latino origin, to please indicate that. The race question has options for white, black, American Indian, Alaska Native, various Asian origin nationalities, and an other race box. But you'll note that there's no Latino Hispanic race on the census. So currently in the 2010 census, or last census, 13% of Latinos just didn't answer the race question at all. Another 37% said other race. And so fully 50% of Latinos didn't give one of the racial groups that's recognized by the Census Bureau. And so there was a lot of testing that went on in the last decade to try to see how can we better ask this question and both acknowledge that there's racial variation in the Latino community, but also get people a box they can feel comfortable checking. And so what they came up with was a combined question format that included Latino Hispanic, but also Middle East or North African, because they're also a group that often does not feel they fit in those traditional boxes that are there. And so this format had white, black, Asian, et cetera, and then also had Latino, Hispanic, and Middle Eastern, North African among the other categories in kind of a check-all-that-apply model. And this really ended up getting a lot of really positive feedback from the focus groups the Census Bureau did, interviews from some of my own research as well on this, and it was put forward. And we had a transition in terms of our administration, and it was no longer allowed to happen for Census 2020. That's one of the reasons also why when the citizenship question came up, it was like, wait, we tested the race question for over a decade and came up with this really great model to use, and we're not being allowed to use it. And yet a question that has had no testing whatsoever being put on the form seemed just really astounding.
Julie Dowling at the University of Illinois Champaign and a member of the U.S. Census Bureau's Advisory Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At the southern border, the migration of people northward appears to be slowing in some areas, in particular places where Mexico deployed its own army and National Guard units last week. But there are concerns that migrants will seek out other places to cross the border. Angela Cocherga covers border issues for the Albuquerque Journal. You've been in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico this week, Angela, just across from your base in El Paso, Texas. What's going on in Ciudad Juarez?
Well, there is a massive presence of Mexico's National Guard up and down the border. They're posted there so that when any migrants, these are largely migrant families, parents and kids trying to cross into the U.S. to ask for asylum, they are stopped. We did see some video from a local Mexican media outlet over the weekend that showed the National Guard chasing people down and dragging a few of them back before they made it to the U.S. But while I was there, the guard said, no, they don't chase people. They do stop them before they cross for their own safety. It's unclear what happens after. One set of troops told me they just, you know, tell people you can't cross and usher them away. Another group told me they actually detain people, call Mexican immigration authorities, and presumably they might be deported.
So it's your impression that even though it's just 10 days since these troops were deployed, it has made a difference in the flow of people northward?
From what we could see, seeing the guard and standing out there with them throughout the day at different points, there were not people crossing. We don't have official numbers yet, but you know, local residents who live along the border on the Mexican side say they've seen a dramatic drop.
Pero sí se ha detenido mucho porque antes se miraba que se echaban parvadas de gente.
So this woman who lives in Juarez, in a neighborhood right along the Rio Grande, along the river, was enjoying a day. Her children were swimming, and she said that she has seen a dramatic drop in the number of people coming across, and other neighbors confirmed that, and they seemed to think the National Guard was a good idea to stop the large groups of people heading into the U.S., but also we're going to take a wait-and-see attitude to see how this all unfolded and what the exact role would be for the National Guard.
So the Mexican National Guard telling these migrants they can't cross at Juarez, where do the migrants go next? Are they returning home?
Not likely if the past is any lesson, because we have seen that no matter how hard it becomes, migrants are going to keep trying. They've made it this far. They've often paid money. They've sold what they can back home. And if they go back, they're empty-handed. So what we understand, and human rights groups and immigrant advocates are saying, they're really concerned that the presence is pushing people and will push people around the edges into more remote areas, desert areas where the temperature now is soaring into well beyond the triple digits, 100, it's going to be 102 where we are today, and then going into remote areas where the Rio Grande is just open and people jump in, and we've had several drownings, which is concerning. We all saw the picture of the father and the young little girl.
Yeah,
so
sure. I mean,
the risk is there'll be more deaths.
Why is Mexico doing this, and why now?
Well, Mexico's president says he is doing it for the safety of the migrants and to stop this flow of human trafficking and to be a good neighbor and cooperate with the U.S. in dealing with this mass migration. It did come right after President Trump threatened to slap a tariff on every single Mexican product coming across, and suddenly the National Guard appeared. And Mexicans, some are critical. They said, why do we have our Mexican National Guard doing the job of the Border Patrol? I mean, we're stopping people from entering the U.S. There's Border Patrol right there. They can that's their job. But, you know, there's also some fatigue in Mexico about the massive numbers of people coming through the country and concern about, you know, especially local communities are bearing the brunt of caring for lots of people in shelters. I mean, what is there's thousands of people waiting to enter the U.S. or being sent back now to wait for their asylum hearing. So that's putting a lot of pressure, kind of a bottleneck in these communities. And they're not getting any funding from the federal government to help.
Angela Kuchergo, the Albuquerque Journal, speaking with us from El Paso, Texas. Always good to speak with you, Angela. Thanks.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's a figure that caught our attention this week, $775. That's how much the government says it costs to keep migrant children in temporary shelters, $775 per child per day. The Department of Health and Human Services runs those shelters. That's where Mark Greenberg worked during the Obama administration. He's now with the Migration Policy Institute.
It's unfortunately been the experience that that's what it has cost to run what are called these influx shelters.
And explain what you mean by influx shelter.
Sure. What happens is when HHS runs out of shelter space, it needs to put in place what are referred to as influx shelters. And the influx shelters historically have cost much more than the standard shelters. So I'm not surprised by this figure of $750 a day or more, but it's really distressing to see it, and it certainly raises lots of questions about whether there shouldn't be better ways of doing this.
And why are the influx shelters so much more expensive?
Generally, the reason is that they have to be set up in a hurry. In a number of instances, they were in remote locations where the staff needed to be hired quickly, sometimes had to be living out of hotels. Because they were short-term facilities, it was harder to enter into long-term contracts for costs. And sometimes water had to be brought in or food had to be brought in. So all of these are things that add to the cost.
So when we're talking about this $750, $775 per child, that's taxpayer money. How much different was the cost when you were overseeing migrant children shelters?
Standard shelter costs have been in the range of about $250 a day, and they appear to have stayed in that range over time. The Obama administration did need to use influx shelters in times when there was a sudden increase in the number of arriving children. But what's really been different over this last year is just using the influx shelter continuously. And part of the reason that that has happened is that HHS adopted last year a set of policies, and it really slowed down the rate at which children could be released from the shelters. Another thing that happened last year was relying on this shelter system as the place children were sent when they were separated from their families, and that added several thousand more children to the system. So all of these factors led to more children being in shelter for longer periods of time, and that then forces the reliance on the influx shelters, which are both hugely expensive but are also not good places for children. It is much harder to provide individual attention to children. The influx facilities are not subject to the protections that come from state licensing and monitoring. So it's both bad for children and bad for the taxpayer.
Mark Greenberg was acting assistant secretary for the Administration for Children and Families in the Obama White House. He's now with the Migration Policy Institute. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The refugee crisis of 2015 and 2016 saw more than a million people leave the Middle East and Africa and head to Europe. One of the countries on the front line of that migration was Greece. Things have slowed down in the last 3 years, but migrants are still coming, and Greece is still struggling to accommodate the tens of thousands of asylum seekers who get stuck there. Many of them have applied for permanent status in Greece, but as Tipa Fernandez reports, some of those migrants who want asylum are learning there's a downside to it.
It's a sticky Friday morning, and Hattare Mohamedian is shuffling belongings between boxes in her tiny one-bedroom apartment. Back in 2016, Mohamedian grabbed her two kids and fled Iran, fearing for her life. She's a lucky asylum seeker. She won her case in 2017, and during the process was found to be vulnerable in the teeming and overcrowded camps, so was given an apartment in Athens. But she's far from happy.
I packed everything. I have no idea. I'm just waiting for a miracle from God that maybe in the last minute he will do something to me.
She has to vacate her apartment on June 30th. On that day, she will also lose her monthly cash subsidy that she received during her asylum process and in the 2 years since winning her case. But she has no place to go with her two children, an elderly mother.
At this moment, I wish I never got my approval as a refugee, because if I was still in asylum seeker, which would entitle me to have a cash card and the help from the praxis to get me a place to stay, and with a little money I could get by till my kids grow up. But at this moment, I have nothing.
Her cash card and apartment are funded through a UN and EU program designed to help asylum seekers. But that support was supposed to end 6 months after she won her case. It's a policy Greece has not enforced until now. The woman interpreting here is Sahar Kamrani, herself a refugee from Iran, who now runs an organization to help other refugees. Kamrani says this wish to have never won refugee status is felt by many of those in Athens who are suddenly subject to the policy. The reality is, there are so many asylum seekers in need of shelter, and there's a severe shortage of housing options. As Mohamedyan and her mother prepare the afternoon meal, they both seem acutely aware it might be one of their last here. Come June 30th, they'll have no kitchen to cook in.
What are you going to do?
I don't know what to do. I really don't know.
Mohamedyan has pounded the pavement looking for her own apartment and for a stable, decent-paying job. But not speaking Greek, it's been almost impossible.
I found the job at the Iranian restaurant because I could do it without the language, for sure I don't speak Greek. So I got the job.
The owner was paying her under the table, the equivalent of about $1.15 an hour. 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week.
But yesterday, the owner of the restaurant was so rude and so aggressive towards me that I actually left the job.
So, as of June 30, she'll have no income and no place to live. Boris Cheshikov is the UNHCR spokesperson in Athens. He says they're ending support for refugees who won their cases back in 2017 for one main reason. It's time for refugees to integrate into Greek society, to be self-sufficient. I told Cheshikov what I was hearing.
People feel like they're being kicked out.
It's also a matter of dependency. The system, the reception system, is created for asylum seekers.
There just isn't money to keep supporting refugees indefinitely once they win their cases, he says. Cheshikov knows how dire the situation is and how little support there is for refugees once they win status. But if they can't make it on their own, he says, they can apply for public assistance, just like impoverished Greeks.
They would be then benefiting from the social welfare system, opening up, however, valuable places for those who are in the horrific conditions of Samos.
Samos is a Greek island that houses thousands of asylum seekers.
There we have children as young as just a few days old, living in garbage-infused small tents.
In other words, Mohamedyan's apartment needs to go to someone else. Dominika Spiratu is with Solidarity Now, a Greek NGO that provides services to refugees. She wants her government to do more for those who have won their asylum cases.
Unless the government comes up with a proper plan, with service provision, alternative accommodation and so on, we may be faced in the future with serious issues including homelessness, poverty.
Yet, she says, it's not just her government's fault that families like Mohamedyan's may end up on the street. When the refugee crisis first began in 2015, many asylum seekers were able to pass through Greece and onto other EU countries. But not anymore.
Well, Europe has closed its borders.
The EU does give Greece money to support asylum seekers. But Greece is still struggling economically. There's high unemployment and the public education and medical systems are overburdened. It's these same public systems that families like Mohamedyan's are now expected to lean on if they need help. And that has Greeks worried, Spiratu says.
People are not against refugees and migrants. What they're really worried about is that, you know, how are we going to live together in a country or a city where There are already so many problems. If we cannot find a job, you will also not be able to find a job. There's going to be more competition.
It's a worry that Mohammed Shafi Abid also has. I met him and his family in a tiny apartment they share with another family. His two-year-old had serious heart issues when he was born, and the family was living in a tent. Shafi and his pregnant wife fled Afghanistan and won temporary asylum in Greece in 2018. Yet today, he's petrified that his young family will be the next to be kicked out of their home. He can't rent anything without a job.
I've been looking for a job about 2 years, ever since I came here, but I didn't get any job. I can be a translator, I can be an interpreter because I speak Urdu, I speak Farsi, I speak Pashto, I speak English, but still I wasn't able to get the job.
His family is not being asked to vacate their apartment on June 30th, but he's worried that his date will come up soon. He says he thought winning asylum would solve his problems.
You have the hope that you will receive the decision from the government and then everything will be all right. But in Greece, it's a different case. If you won, then another problem will start. They give you the answer, positive, and then they will stop supporting you.
A few days before Hatteri Mohamedian's deadline to leave her apartment, I check in with her again. An 11th-hour reprieve. She now has until September 30. But she's not unpacking her boxes yet. The extra few months will be upon her quickly, and she doesn't think she'll get any more help. For The World, Deepa Fernandes, Athens.
Deepa Fernandes is a Pacific Oaks College Reporting Fellow. Her reporting was funded in part by First 5 LA. You're with The World.
Hi. I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. The persecution of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar caught the world's attention the last couple of years, but it goes back to 1978 and the rule of a dictator.
He proceeded to essentially copycat what the Nazis did to the Jews in 1938.
That story ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump landed in Osaka, Japan today for this weekend's G20 summit with world leaders. Trump is scheduled to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Saturday, and there are reports that China is ready to present the U.S. with terms for settling the ongoing trade war. One thing is for sure, whatever happens won't just impact the U.S. and China. Edward Alden is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The effects reverberate around the world, so to the extent that China is exporting less to the United States, there's more going to the rest of the world. So there's more pressure in European markets and elsewhere. It's also what we've seen is a general slowing of the Chinese economy and other economies around the world. So we're actually headed into what looks like a global trade recession, which is a decline in global exports, which we haven't seen for 5 or 6 years now since the end of the Great Recession. So this has knock-on effects around the world. It's not just a U.S.-China story. It's very much a global story.
Which countries do you think would be most affected from a drop in China's exports to the U.S. and also vice versa?
The negative effects are primarily in Europe because as Chinese companies are unable to export to the United States, more of that product is moved to the other advanced markets in the world, and Europe is the primary one. The negative impacts also have to do with the slowdown in the Chinese economy. Because China is exporting less to the United States is seeing slower growth than it would otherwise. And China sucks in a lot of raw materials from around the world, mostly from developing economies in Africa, in Latin America. So they are affected negatively by the slowdown in China.
And Edward, which countries stand to benefit from a U.S.-China trade war?
I mean, the biggest winner so far has been Vietnam by a long shot. So you've seen substantial movement of companies to Vietnam in sectors like toys. Hasbro is moving a lot of production to Vietnam. Furniture, electric cables. You've seen Vietnam's exports to the United States jump by 50% over the past couple of months, even as Chinese exports are slowing substantially. So Vietnam is a big winner. And now, you know, the problem is Vietnam is also potentially being targeted by the United States. President Trump has warned about the rising Vietnamese trade surplus with the United States, saying that the U.S. might now need to go after Vietnam. The other big winner has been Mexico. Mexico is seen potentially as a fairly stable and safe place to invest, given that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have negotiated the new USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. And that, in theory, provides some stability. But, of course, that agreement has not been ratified by the Congress yet. And as President Trump showed a couple of weeks ago, he's still prepared to threaten tariffs on Mexico over unrelated issues. So Mexico may not be quite as secure as a lot of suppliers are hoping.
So the Vietnam example is an interesting one. If Trump does go after Vietnam with tariffs, I mean, what are those manufacturers going to do? Can they just keep jumping around from country to country?
This is a real problem. There does not appear to be any safe harbor in the global economy at the moment. And companies are each on their own trying to make decisions about, well, where's the place that's most likely to be safe going forward? And it isn't clear that there is one. I mean, you can take the example of bicycle manufacturers like Giant and Cannondale and Trek. They had moved a lot of their operations from Taiwan to China because China's production costs were relatively lower than Taiwan. A lot of that is now coming back to Taiwan because they see Taiwan as a safer place, less likely to be hit by American tariffs. But of course, as the U.S.-China conflict grows, there's going to be pressure on Taiwan of various sorts from China. It's not clear that that's a rock-solid safe location over the next 5 years or 10 years. There really, at the moment, doesn't appear to be any place in the world where a company can say, yeah, this is absolutely a safe place for us to be putting our money. And President Trump is encouraging that. I mean, he tweets every couple of weeks, bring your investment to the United States. The only safe place to invest is here inside the United States. If you're anywhere else, you're open to be hit by U.S. tariffs. And so some of this is deliberately being done by the president to try to encourage companies to come back here.
Well, I really appreciate the curtain raiser. Edward Alden at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Thanks very much.
Great to be with you, Marco. Thank you.
After the G20 meetings wrap in Japan, there is talk that President Trump will visit the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins me now. This visit to the DMZ isn't a sure thing, Patrick, but what would Trump hope to accomplish if he goes there?
If Trump does go to the DMZ, it won't be the exact same DMZ that Obama or Bush would have visited. The president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, has tried to turn the DMZ into more a symbol of unity and peace instead of a big, scary barbed wire and landmines type of thing. If Trump is taken to the DMZ by Moon Jae-in, I imagine that the vibe will be, look at these opportunities for peace and unity.
Why is the DMZ symbolically important?
Oh, I mean, one of the more horrific wars was fought before it was installed. I mean, that was a war in which, according to the American side, we killed roughly 20% of the population on the peninsula, heavy American casualties as well. And so it's been there for many, many decades as the symbol of a war interrupted.
So the U.S. wants to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Many other observers want to address North Korea's human rights abuses. What does North Korea want?
For starters, North Korea wants those crushing sanctions lifted. The U.S. has led the sanctions regime that really chokes off North Korea from the global economy. But when it comes to nuclear weapons, North Korea wants to go step by step. They give up a little something. The U.S. gives up a little something. The U.S. wants North Korea to immediately give up everything, allow inspectors in, to just totally give up the goose 100%, and then they'll offer some economic aid and help. So there's a real schism in the difference between the way they want to approach this.
If Trump does show up at the DMZ, it would be kind of a third point in an intriguing series of moments. Trump will have met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping of the G20, and Xi himself actually just met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Connect the dots, Patrick. Does this choreography suggest at all a path to a diplomatic solution with North Korea?
Xi Jinping would certainly like to see Kim Jong-un to be less feisty. He'd like to see Trump be less feisty. He doesn't like the conflict between North Korea and the United States. Xi Jinping may see himself as needing to play a middleman between Kim Jong-un and Trump.
There's a new human rights story emerging today from North Korea, the disappearance of an Australian graduate student in Pyongyang named Alec Sigley. What can you tell us?
Alec has gone missing, meaning that he hasn't communicated with his friends or family since Tuesday, which is highly unusual. He's a really big presence on Twitter, so even I've noticed that he hasn't been tweeting in the last few days. And we don't know that he's been detained. That's certainly the fear. It's just unclear what has happened to him. And I think a lot of people are very worried. Australia doesn't have an embassy in Pyongyang, so they're having to reach out through other countries.
Now, you've interviewed Alec a few times. What's his background?
He's a really interesting guy. He's very bright. He's very scholarly. He has taught himself Korean, so he speaks Korean in the northern dialect. He's studying North Korean literature at the top university in North Korea, which is very unusual because he's Australian. He's one of the very few Westerners who is in North Korea and tweeting about it. I mean, if you go and look at his Twitter, he gives you these interesting slice-of-life moments where he jokes about singing Iron Maiden at North Korean karaoke bars.
Wow.
So that's the type of stuff he puts out. It's not political. He's not an ideologue at all. But he's also not... he's not a kook. I mean, you have these kooks who will defend Kim Jong-un and the North Korean regime no matter what they do. He's not like that at all. He's really interested in providing sort of a portal between the West and North Korea, interpreting what happens in North Korean society.
Are you seeing what media are saying about the Alec Sigley story? Like, do you sense any concerns of a reprise of the story of the late Otto Warmbier?
Yeah, I don't see it as a very strong connection. Otto was a guy who was just interested in visiting North Korea because he was curious. Alec is someone who has been living there. He actually operates his own tour company, bringing Westerners to Pyongyang and showing them around himself. Very connected. In my conversations with him, he's imparted that, you know, even to be able to attend university in Pyongyang, he had to have certain connections. So he knows people in North Korea, whereas Otto was simply a tourist.
Well, here's hoping we hear word from Alec Sigley soon. Reporter Patrick Nguyen covers all things Asia for The World. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
In Argentina, it's a rerun. Last summer, the country was fixated on a debate in Congress over whether to make abortion legal in Argentina, a predominantly Catholic country. The lower house passed legislation to decriminalize abortion, but the measure narrowly failed in the Senate. This year is an election year in Argentina, and now advocates are trying again to make Argentina one of just a couple of countries in Latin America to ease restrictions on abortion. The World's Alison Herrera takes a look at the abortion debate in Argentina.
Victoria Tesserero is exhausted. She's been on planes and in airports for more than 30 hours. She just flew back to Buenos Aires from the Cannes Film Festival after a screening of the documentary Que Sea Ley, Let It Be Law. It's about last year's failed bid to legalize abortion in Argentina. Tesserero and other activists walk the red carpet, waving green scarves, chanting, solidarity for women. Tesserero is the head of a national campaign to make abortion legal in Argentina. And she says the international attention they received at Cannes, it makes a difference at home.
To position the issue of abortion internationally, it makes more pressure to the Argentinian government.
Abortion in Argentina has been illegal since the 1880s. It's only permitted in case of rape and incest and when a woman's life is in danger. But a growing movement here against violence against women has helped put abortion on the political map. advocates like Tesorero helped reintroduce another abortion bill in Congress in May.
Every woman or person with capacity of gestation has the right to decide to interrupt pregnancy up to the 14th week of pregnancy. And the state has to ensure that decision.
Even though a similar bill failed in the Argentine Senate last summer, it's energized a movement here to decriminalize abortion in this mostly Catholic country. It's also mobilized a counter-movement to keep the restrictions firmly in place. Thousands of people marched against abortion this spring, waving blue scarves. Guadalupe Batajan was one of those marchers. She started volunteering with an anti-abortion campaign right after the debates in Congress in 2018. Their slogan? Save two lives, as in the life of a woman and her unborn baby.
We are really amazed to see our message here in Argentina spreading to other countries, including the United States, where I have even seen photos of blue scarves like ours at a march. That means there are people who think like us, regardless of what the law says there.
Batajan says she thinks abortion should be outlawed in all instances. And she cites a case that made headlines earlier this year of an 11-year-old rape victim who was initially blocked from getting an abortion.
Personally, I am not in favor of abortion in the case of rape. Because even if someone has been the victim of a crime, that doesn't give her the right to commit another crime by taking another life.
Even though abortion is highly restricted, Argentina's health minister has estimated there are more than 350,000 clandestine abortions a year, and the number may be much higher. Batajan says her group has set up centers for pregnant women in poor areas outside of the capital, where they offer free food and classes. She says they want to provide alternatives for women who think they don't have any other options. Those are the kind of women Luciana Anguera sees at her health clinic in Via Fiorito, an hour outside of Buenos Aires. Many people in this community work as day laborers when they can find any work at all. Anguera says most of the women who come in are struggling, and some tell her that their husbands won't let them use birth control.
Because there are a lot of men who think that if a woman uses birth control, she's cheating on them. And some women see themselves as the property of their men.
Anguera estimates that she sees four women a week looking to get abortion pills.
They don't have any more room in their houses to have more kids.
While she supports the push to ease restrictions on abortion, Anguera wonders whether both sides of the abortion debate have left the women she works with out of the conversation. Victoria Tesorero says she's aware of those concerns. She's heard complaints that her abortion rights campaign is elitist. Things like,
you are classy, you are middle-income, white women, academic, asking for abortion, only from the cities.
But Tesorero says the rights she's pushing for would protect all women. She says it seems especially important at a time when a country like the United States might be rolling back legal protections for abortion. Women in Argentina have to pull together, she says. They can't afford to look back. For The World, Allison Herrera, Buenos Aires.
Allison's reporting was supported by a grant from the International Women's Media Foundation. The International Criminal Court wants to open a full investigation into Myanmar's alleged crimes against Rohingya Muslims. Those allegations include killings and forced deportations. The investigation would focus on the country's 2017 military crackdown when 700,000 Rohingya fled to neighboring Bangladesh. But a new documentary called Exiled makes clear that Myanmar's persecution of the Rohingya goes back much further to 1978 and the dictatorship of General Ne Win.
He proceeded to essentially copycat what the Nazis did to the Jews in 1938. His legal advisors come up with the citizenship law. The intention was to make sure that Rohingyas were no longer entitled to either basic rights
or citizenship rights.
And that desire of the leaders of Myanmar to rid the country of Rohingyas continues to this day. Journalist Shahida Tulaganova directed and produced Exiled. How far back does the targeting of the Rohingya in Burma go?
The first exodus of Rohingya from what was then Burma happened in 1978. That was under precise orders from then dictator General Ne Win. About 200,000 people moved from Burma to Bangladesh at that time.
Was there a reason given for why this all started?
Basically, Burma is a patchwork of different ethnic groups and regions which were glued together after the British left. So when dictatorship came in place in 1962 and General Ne Win came to power, he had an idea that Burma should be a country with a particular look, meaning Chinese looking, and they should be all Buddhists. So obviously the Rohingyas didn't really fit in this description. They were darker looking, they were Muslims, they didn't really assimilate that well with the general Burmese Buddhist culture. And they were clustered mainly in the Rakhine state.
There is more than one Burmese analyst in your documentary who calls what's happened to the Rohingya a genocide, which is, as we all know, a really strong term. What did you learn making your film that persuaded you that that is, in fact, what's been going on?
Well, I studied international law at a certain stage, and I did the UN exam on human rights, so I kind of know what is called genocide, what is not called genocide. But a systematic persecution of an ethnic minority over the years, when it is a government strategy implemented consistently with the aim to either exterminate the population or drive them out of the country, is by definition a genocide. The only problem with the UN of recognizing genocides, as we already know from Rwanda and Bosnia, it always recognized after the fact.
Shahida, what were, like, in this system of genocide, what were some of the elements that you saw that suggested you had seen this before in history?
What struck me is that in my film, one of the stars, so-called, the show is General Kinu, who used to be for many, many years head of military intelligence in Burma and then briefly president or prime minister of Burma. He was directly in charge of developing the policies of driving the Rohingyas out of Burma. He never calls them Rohingya, he calls them Bengalis, which is wrong. I spoke to him for about 3 hours, and I felt like he really doesn't like Muslims to the point like he thinks that they do not belong and never belong to Burma. So from his point of view, they had to be out. So he set up the organization called NASAKA, and NASAKA was notoriously known horrendous human rights abuses, including abduction, forced labor, and rape of the Rohingya population in the Rakhine state from 1991 up until 2012.
How would you characterize Aung San Suu Kyi's role in the persecution of the Rohingya? Is she an active or a passive participant?
Well, it's difficult to say active or passive. I mean, how active or how passive you could be. If
right.
you don't participate in active killing, it doesn't make you very active. But if you're de facto leader of the country and you're complicit in what's happening and you pretend that you don't know anything about it and you refuse to call this ethnic minority by their name, she never refers to them as Rohingya, they call them the Muslims. So I think she's trying to navigate very difficult political waters because she understands that she's not in charge of the country. The military is still in charge. So instead of publicly criticizing the military for their horrific attacks on Rohingya, especially from 2016 and 2017, she in 2017 flew into the Rakhine state in a military helicopter and shaking hands with the military. So she became part of the strategy of extermination of the Rohingya. She's used by the military, and I think she understands that very well.
I'm speaking with journalist Shahida Tulaganova. She's a director and producer of the film Exiled about the persecution of the Rohingya in Myanmar or Burma. Shahida, what do you think most people don't get about the Rohingya? Like, what was the void you were trying to fill in with your documentary?
I was trying to tell the story of a genocide, and genocide applies to many, many countries. The problem with the Rohingya, this region is so far away. The only reason we started talking about them in 2017, because when the UNHCR video showed masses of people crossing the border over the river, and that shocked the world. to see this happening. Otherwise, nobody paid attention to them. They were so isolated. They're so far away. My job was to tell the story. That's why I wanted to go back to 1948 and tell people they always lived there. They belong there. There's nothing the Burmese government can say will ever deny them of the fact that they lived there for centuries, and we need to understand it.
Do you think the government, the current government, is going to try and expel the remaining Rohingya? Several hundred thousand, you said.
I would say wait for another couple of years and it's going to be another exodus. There are about 250,000 Rohingya locked in ghettos and concentration camps inside the Rakhine State. They don't have access to medication. They don't have access for schools. They cannot leave those ghettos. They're forbidden. And I think this is the main group which we have to seriously be concerned about, because there's no access for independent media to verify the situation they're in. And I think those guys would be driven out of Burma, given another couple of years, I would say.
Shahida Tulaganova is the director and producer of the documentary Exiled, about the systemic persecution of the Rohingya in Myanmar. Thank you very much, Shahida.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow on the show. It's about a law passed right after 9/11, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, also known as the AUMF. It allowed the White House to go after Osama bin Laden without asking Congress. Although bin Laden is gone, the law remains on the books, and there's concern it could be used again, this time against Iran. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
There's no doubt there is a connection between the Islamic Republic of Iran and al-Qaeda.
But actually, there are many doubts about the connection between Iran and al-Qaeda. The AUMF and the potential for military action against Iran, we'll hear all about that tomorrow right here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for making it today.
PRI, Public Radio International.